You're listening to the Biographics Podcast. This episode is something that originally aired on a YouTube channel we do. If you'd like to get the latest videos before they come to the podcast form, please do consider heading over to YouTube and just plug in Biographics, spelt the same way that this podcast's name is spelt, and you will see all of our videos. They were designed for video first, but we just wanted to make them accessible to people in the podcast format. So please consider doing that. Also, if you'd like to leave us a review, a rating, wherever you get your podcasts, that would be amazing. It really does help us out. It gets this in front of more people, which is always a good thing. It really keeps us making it. I like reading the reviews. So there's that. And let's get into today's episode.
By the age of 24, Hermann Göring was a famous combat pilot, a national hero, and leader of Germany's most celebrated fighter squadron. By the time of his death, less than 30 years later, he was reviled as a monster with the blood of millions on his hands. Highly decorated combat pilot, drug-addicted lunatic, international statesman, and one of the 20th century's most notorious criminals, Göring's life was one of soaring highs and crashing lows. And in the Biographics video this week, we explore the life of this man. The young Hermann Göring enjoyed a privileged upbringing. His own mother and father had little money, but his Jewish godfather, Dr. Hermann Epstein, was fabulously wealthy, and he welcomed the Görings to live at one of his two castles. This apparent act of altruism was no doubt influenced by the fact that Epstein was having an affair with Göring's mother. If Hermann was aware of this, then he didn't seem to mind. The two became close, with Epstein encouraging Hermann in his love of hunting, climbing, and adventure. When Göring developed an interest in all things military, it was again his Jewish godfather who pulled some strings to have the boy enrolled at the prestigious military academy at Karlsruhe. In 1914, the great European powers went to war. Göring was by then 21 years old and serving in an infantry regiment, but sensing there would be better opportunities for glory elsewhere, he applied to join the Imperial German Flying Corps. Göring began his new career as an observer, but when the opportunity arose to get behind the controls, he seized it with both hands. He proved to be a natural flyer, and thanks to the countless hours he'd spent hunting, he was already a lethal marksman. This was a deadly combination for an aspiring combat pilot. By October 1915, Göring was newly qualified and hungry for glory. He only had to wait a little over a month before he scored his first kill, and by June 1916, his tally had risen to 3. Few professions in history have ever been quite as dangerous as a World War I pilot, and in November 1916, he was shot down for the first and only time. Accounts of the incident are sketchy and contradictory, but there's no doubt that Göring did suffer an injury that kept him out of action for several months. On returning to duties, he began to rack up kills at an impressive rate. He rose through the ranks of aces, winning numerous awards for bravery, and his fame began to grow. His face was printed on collectible matchboxes, newspapers and magazines featured articles on him, and everywhere he went, people treated him like a celebrity. Göring, he adored the attention. In April 19, the Germans suffered a major blow when their greatest pilot, Manfred von Richthofen, better known to history as the Red Baron, was shot down and killed. Richthofen had been commander of an elite squadron made up of Germany's finest airmen. It was assumed that his replacement would be drawn from their ranks, and the likes of Ernest Udet and Lothar von Richthofen, the Red Baron's brother, were considered the most likely candidates. But as it turned out, it was actually Hermann Göring who landed the job. This came as something of a surprise. Göring, he hadn't been part of the Richthofen squadron, and he was still some way off the top of the charts in terms of kills. However, Göring had skill, he had charm, and he seemed to be a natural leader. Göring took charge of the Richthofen squadron at a difficult time. The balance of power in the air had swung back and forth through the war, but now the Allies were firmly in the ascendancy. German aircraft production couldn't keep up with the British and French factories. Attrition and exhaustion were taking their toll on German pilots as well. The situation on the ground, it was equally desperate. Shortly before Göring's promotion, the United States of America had declared war on Germany, a huge offensive designed to knock France out of the war before American troops arrived in any great numbers failed. Germany sued for peace, and the armistice came into effect on the 11th of November, 1918. Göring's last orders were to lead his squadron to a French airfield where their aircraft would be handed over to the Allies. In a tearful final speech to his men, he predicted, "Our time will come again." Goering's exploits made him a household name, but he missed the excitement that the war had provided. Recruiting four other pilots from amongst his wartime comrades, he put on a series of highly dangerous acrobatic shows, dazzling thousands of onlookers with his daring stunt flying. When the public began to lose their appetite for this sort of spectacle, he took on a more modest job flying charter planes. It was during this time that he met the love of his life. Countess Karin von Foch was sickly and frail and already married, but she was also wealthy and beautiful. For Goering, it was love at first sight. Karin, she felt the same way about the dashing airman, and in 1922 she abandoned her husband and her child to make a new life with Goering in Munich. It was here that the couple first encountered Adolf Hitler. At this point in history, Hitler was still something of a non-entity, a rabble-rousing demagogue with little real power or influence. Karin, however, she was entranced, and she was determined to form an alliance between Goering and this Austrian corporal. Goering willingly bound his fate to that of Adolf Hitler, and in November of 1923, he joined his master in a plot to overthrow the government. 2,000 Nazis, with Hitler and Goering side by side in the front rank, marched on the Bavarian War Ministry. Hitler believed the police would not oppose them, but he underestimated their resolve. They opened fire, and Hitler fell, or by some accounts fled, while Goering was badly wounded by a bullet to his thigh. Hitler and his conspirators, they were now wanted criminals, and this was a particularly difficult situation for Goering since he was one of the most recognizable faces in all of Germany. While Hitler was arrested, Goering chose to flee. Having received treatment from, ironically enough, a Jewish doctor, Goering and Karin crossed the Austrian border. The next 2 years would be the most miserable of Goering's life. Goering's wound became badly infected, and in Austria he was given injections of morphine to ease the pain. This was the beginning of an addiction that would almost cost Goering his sanity and even his life. The once athletic ace pilot's weight had ballooned. Karin sold most of her possessions to fund Goering's habit, and his wild mood swings left her fearing for her life. Faced with the very real possibility of losing Karin, Goering agreed to enter into a withdrawal program. During the Great War, the first battle of Goering's life, he had fought for his country, for personal glory and for prestige. His second great struggle against morphine addiction had none of that glamour. It was a fight he very nearly lost. He screamed at his nurses that he wanted to meet death and even attempted to physically attack them. For his own safety and the safety of everyone around him, he was forced into a straitjacket and confined to a padded cell. To Karin's relief, Goering emerged from the depths of his own personal hell, and he was discharged from the asylum in October of 1925. Less than a year afterwards, the German government granted him an amnesty, absolving him of his crimes. He was free to return home and to resume his service to Adolf Hitler, who had been himself released after just 9 months in prison. Having failed to gain control of Germany by force, Hitler instead attempted to seize power through the ballot box. In order to accomplish this, he needed wealthy backers to embrace the nationalist socialist cause. Hitler was a brilliant public speaker, capable of whipping crowds into a frenzy, but in more intimate social settings, he was awkward and uncomfortable. Most of the other senior Nazis were unsophisticated thugs. Only Goering was entirely at home, wining and dining German society's elites. Goering threw himself into his new role with huge energy and commitment, but his beloved Karin's health was by now seriously deteriorating. In October of 1931, she collapsed and died, leaving Goering distraught. He would later commission the building of a huge country residence set in 40,000 hectares of woodland, naming it Karin Hall in her memory. In January of 1933, Hitler succeeded in maneuvering himself into the position of Chancellor of Germany. Goering's reward for his years of service was to be appointed Prussian Minister of the Interior. Through his ministerial salary, corruption, and bribes, he found the means to fund a lifestyle that was becoming opulent to the point of absurdity. To go along with his mansions, his exotic pets, and his increasingly ostentatious uniforms, Goering, he also held real political power. His first step was to Nazify the police, sacking 22 police chiefs and replacing them with men sympathetic to National Socialism. With the police's loyalty assured, he ordered them to crush subversive elements in society, which in practice meant Jews and communists. Goering made no attempt to distance himself from these killings. He stated, "Every bullet fired from the barrels of a police pistol is my bullet. If you call that murder, then I am a murderer. Everything has been ordered by me." The biggest threat to Hitler, however, did not come from the communists, but from within the Nazi Party itself. The thugs of the SA, the Nazi Party's own paramilitary army, had been useful to Hitler in his rise to power, but they'd become a bit of a problem. Hitler wanted the SA to be broken up, but its commander, Ernst Röhm, openly defied him. The men of the SA, they were loyal to Röhm. If he attempted an armed coup, he might just succeed in toppling Hitler. Göring, who hated Röhm and recognized a very real threat to his own power, he urged his Führer to act. And reluctantly, Hitler agreed. On June 30, 1934, the Night of the Long Knives began. It was time for Hitler to settle some old scores. Ernst Röhm was arrested and shot, as were dozens of those who had angered or obstructed Hitler in one way or the other. Much of the planning had been entrusted to Göring, who executed the operation with great skill and a complete lack of moral scruples. Hitler's position within the party, it had now become unassailable, but he was already looking forward to the day when he could attack Germany's neighbors and avenge her defeat in the Great War. Germany was banned from building an air force under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, so Göring was tasked with building it up in secret. The Germans had been preparing for the day when their air force would rise once again since long before the days of Hitler coming to power. While Germans were barred from developing military aircraft, the ban on civilian aircraft had been lifted in 1922. Since then, the German aviation industry had produced numerous fast mail-carrying planes that could easily be converted into fighters and airliners that could be converted into bombers. Lufthansa, Germany's state-owned airline, which was formed in 1926, would provide many of the pilots for Göring's fledgling Luftwaffe. Showered with lavish funding, Göring's fledgling Luftwaffe grew quickly, and in March of 1935, its existence was officially announced to the world. Over the next 4 years, the Luftwaffe would receive four times as much investment as Britain's RAF and more than 10 times that of France's Air Force. Unlike the Allied Air Forces, it was designed specifically to operate in support of Germany's ground forces. The world-class Messerschmitt 109 became operational in 1937, and it formed the backbone of the Luftwaffe's fighter force. The Junkers Ju-87 Stuka dive bomber, a machine for which neither the British nor the French had any direct equivalent, would provide support for Germany's fast-moving armored spearheads. As Göring later told his captors in 1945, "We armed Germany until we bristled." Göring didn't entirely share Hitler's enthusiasm for war, and this wasn't due to any sense of compassion for the millions who would die, but simply because he had too much to lose. His time was spent mixing with high society, indulging his passions for hunting and collecting art, and expanding his own personal empire within the Reich. Unlike Hitler, he didn't see himself as being on some sort of quasi-divine mission to restore German greatness. He simply pursued a political career because it brought him personal power and enormous wealth. Where Hitler thought victory was inevitable, Göring knew it wasn't and feared he might find himself on the losing side. Despite the reservations of many of his generals, Hitler chose war, and on the 1st of September 1939, Germany invaded Poland. The Luftwaffe was at this time the most powerful air force in the world. Its commander-in-chief, however, was largely untested as a military commander. In World War I, he had spent a few months in command of a single squadron, but that was a very different matter to directing operations of an entire air force in a very modern war. While Göring possessed the intelligence and ruthlessness of a great military commander, he would fail miserably in the role. This was at least in part because the corpulent Göring had far too much on his plate. In addition to being the Luftwaffe's commander-in-chief, he was also responsible for civilian and military aviation policy, the Reich's anti-aircraft defenses, industrial and economic policy, and a good deal more than that. These responsibilities were far too much for any one man, particularly one who was once again sliding into drug addiction. In 1937, Göring had been prescribed the painkiller Percodan, a morphine derivative to treat a severe toothache. The toothache eventually went away, but Göring kept on taking the drugs. As the war turned against Germany, Göring continued to up his dosage. His drug use compounded his weaknesses as a military leader. His continual overestimation of the Luftwaffe's capabilities, his tendency to retreat from reality rather than face up to bad news, and a desire to please Hitler, which repeatedly led to him making promises the Luftwaffe could not keep, sometimes with catastrophic results. Goering's fading capabilities were not immediately apparent. In the attack on Poland, the Luftwaffe made short work of the Polish Air Force and its obsolete machines. In 1940, it was France's turn, and the Luftwaffe once again dominated the skies as German tanks emerged from the supposedly impassable Ardennes forest, threatening to encircle the best of the French and British divisions. As the British prepared to evacuate their army from the continent, the German armored spearheads were in position to sweep into Dunkirk and deal what might have been a death blow to the British expeditionary force. Goering, however, persuaded Hitler that his Luftwaffe could finish the job on its own. The German tanks were halted and the Luftwaffe hit the British with everything they had. The limits of what air power could and could not achieve had not yet been established, and nobody had ever attempted to destroy an army from the air. If Goering had have given the matter sufficient thought, he might not have been so confident. The vast artillery bombardments of World War I were not enough to win battles without support, and the Luftwaffe couldn't come close to matching that kind of hitting power. Goering's boasts proved hollow, and a huge armada of ships plucked the British expeditionary force to safety across the English Channel. With the British having fled the continent and the French signing an armistice on the 22nd of June 1940, Hitler was bemused and enraged to discover that Britain had no intention of giving up the fight. He began planning an invasion, but stipulated that it couldn't go ahead until Britain's Royal Air Force had been destroyed as an effective fighting force. Once again, Goering was on hand to assure Hitler that his Luftwaffe would make short work of the RAF. He believed the Luftwaffe to be superior in every respect, but this simply wasn't the case. The British had roughly the same number of fighters as the Luftwaffe, and their Supermarine Spitfires were every bit as good as the German Me-109s. Britain also had the advantage of radar and a sophisticated ground control system, and thanks to Goering's inability to get the most out of the German economy, British factories were producing more fighter aircraft per month than the entire Reich. Goering also believed himself to be on the brink of victory throughout the Battle of Britain, but he never came as close as he imagined. Goering's third big mistake of the war, and almost certainly his most calamitous, came in the wake of Hitler's ill-judged invasion of the Soviet Union. When the Sixth Army became encircled at Stalingrad, its only hope was to attempt an immediate breakout. Hitler hated the idea of retreat under any circumstances, so when Goering claimed the trapped army could be supplied from the air, the Führer seized upon the suggestion. The idea was total nonsense. Goering's staff knew it, and Goering really should have known it too. The result was the complete destruction of the Sixth Army, and Stalingrad became the turning point of World War II. So, at this point, Hitler no longer trusted Goering, and the Luftwaffe chief's reputation plunged to new lows as the Allied bombing campaign systematically destroyed German cities. Goering now did his best to stay out of Hitler's way. Rather than attend to his many responsibilities, he spent the bulk of his time hunting at Carenhall, plundering Europe for works of art to add to his enormous collection, and consuming ever greater quantities of drugs. On April 30, 1945, Hitler committed suicide. With the Reich collapsing all around him, Goering knew that the war was lost. Unlike most other top Nazis who either killed themselves or attempted to flee, Goering seemed to be under the bizarre impression that he hadn't done much wrong and therefore had little to fear. On May the 9th, he surrendered himself to the Americans along with 20,000 painkillers and one of the world's largest art collections, most of it looted from all across Europe. Goering had expected an audience with Eisenhower. Instead, he was accused of crimes against humanity and waging wars of aggression. His guilt or innocence of these charges would be decided at trial. While the prosecution prepared their case, Goering was weaned off his drug addiction and placed on a strict diet. The result was that the much diminished Goering, who had blundered his way through the war, was now restored to the cunning, manipulative force of old. Of the 21 leading Nazis on trial at Nuremberg, Goering was the most senior. He didn't expect to escape a death penalty, but he did intend to go down fighting. In one early exchange, he rang so many rings around the prosecutor that the American threw down his headphones and refused to continue with the cross-examination. Goering's argument was that he hadn't wanted war and had worked to avoid it. When forced to fight through circumstances outside of his control, he had done so with the principles of a noble Teutonic knight. It was not in his nature to harm women or children, and he had known nothing of the Holocaust. Given his powers of self-delusion, he may well have convinced himself that this was true. Whatever the case, he was enjoying being center stage again, at least until he was presented with evidence that shattered this image of himself as a noble warrior. The idea that Göring could have known nothing of the Holocaust was absurd, but there was little documentary evidence to link him directly to it. However, there were plenty of documents indicating that he had participated in the persecution of Jews and personally profited from it. Not only that, but tens of thousands of slave laborers had toiled and died in the Luftwaffe's factories, and under Göring's leadership, the Luftwaffe had conducted horrific and often lethal experiments on Jews, gypsies, and prisoners of war. He'd plundered Europe for works of art, ordered prisoners to be shot, and had Allied airmen lynched. The judge found Göring guilty on all charges and passed down a sentence of death by hanging. Göring objected. He was a soldier, and as such, he should be executed by firing squad rather than hanged like a common criminal. When his demand was refused, Göring took matters into his own hands. On October the 15th, he bit down on a cyanide capsule. Quite how Göring obtained this cyanide capsule is still not known for sure. His suicide note explained that he felt no obligation to submit to his enemy's justice. While awaiting trial, he had told psychologists that within 50 years there would be a statue of him in every German town. Göring's opinion of himself had not been dented at all by defeat, but his judgment of his place in history was certainly well wide of the mark. His exploits as a brave fighter pilot have been utterly eclipsed by his crimes. Few men have ever trashed their reputation quite so comprehensively as Hermann Göring.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode of the Biographics Podcast. Leave us a review. Why not? You can do that wherever you get your podcasts, or a rating, or however these things work. I like reading them. It makes me feel good when they're positive. It lets me know what you don't like when they're negative. Also, if you want to say hi, say let me know how I'm doing with this podcast, just drop me an email. It's simon@biographics.org. Biographics spelled the same way that the name of this podcast is spelled. So again, that's simon@biographics.org. Drop me an email, say hi, let me know how you like this podcast. And as always, I'll see you next time.